Hello, everyone. Welcome to Senate Finance. Time is about 7 minutes after 5. It is Thursday, February 20th. Present at the table, Senator Fairclough, Senator Bishop, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Meyer, and myself, Senator Kelly. We are going to continue with our overviews that we were getting on the SB 138, which is not before us, but it will be next week, we anticipate, and we wanted to use this time to get the committee up to speed and staff up to speed on what are the guts of the bill. So, given that, we have Commissioner Balash here from DNR to talk to us, and then is Deputy Commissioner Pulaski going to be a part of this? I've got him on my list, is the only reason I ask. And
he doesn't need to be.
Okay. So
we can get him if you like.
You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joe Balash. I'm the Commissioner Designee for the Department of Natural Resources, and I understand that folks wanted to hear a little bit about how we got to this point. So I've put together some slides that I used in another situation to help paint some of that story. Try not to be too detailed, but I think I have a unique perspective to offer both the committee as well as the public. In 2004, I was the incoming committee aide to the Budget and Audit Committee, signed a confidentiality agreement that gave me access to the materials and documents that were being exchanged between the administration and various applicants under the Stranded Gas Development Act. So while I didn't necessarily have a seat at the table in the negotiations that were conducted in that particular phase, I did have a front row seat. And at the turn of the administration in 2006, I left the legislative branch and joined the governor's office and was part of the team that put together the AGEA statute and framework that has been in place since. As another transition occurred in 2010, the people associated with AGEA largely exited stage right, and I managed to retain employment with the governor, this time in the Department of Natural Resources, and so I've had a very close view of that full period of time and the transition that we've gone through in that period. So like any human being, I come with my own biases, and what I saw, what I witnessed is probably colored by those. But as many of the members here around the table, some of you also got to witness that. Senator Hoffman has seen more than one episode of this show, and from a different vantage point. So hopefully what I have to offer the committee is helpful to put some of this into context and help members understand how we got specifically to the point we are at this juncture. When it comes to commercializing North Slope's gas resources, you know, there are some key principles that really matter. And, you know, we want to make sure that we get gas to Alaskans, that we maximize the value of that resource base that exists at Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson. And the way to maximize that value is to get the most efficient transportation system possible through high volume and export sales. And finally, we want a project that's going to incentivize additional exploration and development and support continued investment in our oil and gas exploration. We have far more resource potential beyond what is present in those two fields, and if we're going to truly realize that potential, we need to make sure that we have a system that encourages third parties to go out and invest and find that gas resource. So the benefits, these should look familiar. The benefits to the state that come from commercialization, these come, I think, straight out of the HOA. The in-state gas opportunity, the large revenues that will accrue to the state through large gas sales, creation of jobs, both in the construction but also in the operation of the project in the long term. Additional opportunities for our businesses, our contractors, and the infrastructure that's going to support additional exploration and development beyond the existing footprint at Prudhoe and Point Thomson. So what are the state's interests? Certainly, we want to see the gas at Prudhoe and Point Thomson, roughly 32 to 34 trillion cubic feet, developed, monetized, and sold into markets. But we have so much more potential beyond those two fields that we want to keep a very close eye on how the infrastructure is set up, how the business is organized, so that we can hopefully encourage the exploration and development of what the USGS estimates to be more than 200 trillion cubic feet of gas potential onshore on the North Slope. In order to encourage that sort of activity, we need a couple of things. Number one, we need to have access to the pipeline infrastructure. And number two, that access needs to come at a reasonable tariff rate, one that allows or supports the economics of exploration and ultimately development of those additional gas resources. The numbers I'm talking about are all in the conventional category. When you start to take a look at the unconventional opportunities present on the North Slope, the numbers get to be truly staggering. Whether we're talking about tight resources, shale resources, natural gas hydrates, the opportunities, once we have a path to market, are going to be extraordinary. So, a little bit of history, and you know, when my wife said yes and married me, she thought I was going to be a history teacher and a wrestling coach. She doesn't much care for politics, and she's still a little pissed off. So, if I spend too much time on the history here, please move me along, Mr. Chairman. The Alaska Gasline Inducement Act was born in the aftermath of the failed Stranded Gas Development Act process, and there were some things that we as a state did that were truly a visceral reaction to not do the SGDA over again. We rather than getting involved in any way, shape, or form directly as an equity participant, sought to rely solely on a private sector agent, a private sector sponsor, one who was going to come in and establish a business, an offering of transportation service that met some critical state interests. And we were, rather than, again, taking a direct equity role, going to reimburse their risk capital in order to induce them to take on this task, to establish and develop a pipeline that had low tariffs through a high debt-to-equity ratio in their capital structure, and to conduct their business with a favorable expansion policy. The expectation at the time was that with such a long lead time associated with development of the project, gathering the environmental information, doing the engineering work, and ultimately getting the federal permits required, that we were going to have 4 or 5 years in front of us. And that would give us time to negotiate with the producers to establish the fiscal terms that everybody acknowledges are necessary for a project like this to go forward. So to put some of this in context, in 2007, the AGIA process itself was laid out in a statute that was adopted by the legislature in 2007. That bill was passed by the legislature in May. The administration then set out an application process over the course of the summer that required applications to be received by December 1st. Now, a little sideline, before December 1st in the fall, we had a little exercise here, a special session that resulted in the passage of a change to our oil tax system, ACES, that also had an impact on the backdrop here. With those applications received in December, there were five of them, and only one of them was determined to be complete and qualify for the inducement package. As the agencies continued to evaluate those applications that came in and the one qualifying one that was filed by TransCanada, the two producers at Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk, Denali, BP and ConocoPhillips announced the formation of Denali, a pipeline project that was going to largely cover the same route and configuration, same size, as the application submitted by TransCanada. And it was, I think, well received across the board that those two companies in particular were prepared to step forward and offer a competitive proposal. As the year went by, in May, the commissioners of DNR and DOR at the time found the TransCanada application to be worthy of a recommendation to award the license fully to TransCanada. And around that time, things were getting a little interesting on the energy front. Deliverability in Cook Inlet was getting rather tight in the winter. Oil prices were rising rapidly, and the corresponding prices for Cook Inlet gas were also rising. And there was a real need and recognition for the need that North Slope Gas could provide energy not only to South Central, but also to the interior. And so in July, through the encouragement of the governor at the time, NSTAR and ANGDA announced an in-state pipeline partnership. Their plan was to start in the south and build north up to Fairbanks with the intention to be the spur line off of the major pipeline that would connect on into Canada and into lower 48 markets. That plan didn't last long. It was a bit of a forced marriage that didn't work out at all. ANGDA and NSTAR just had different views and missions and soon found themselves not working together. But by the end of that summer, the AGIA license was approved by the legislature and later that year ultimately signed when the effective date of the underlying bill had been reached. And so at that point, we were fully signed up with TransCanada as our partner. They had stepped up to the plate, submitted a fully compliant application that met the state's requirements, and they started to qualify for reimbursement dollars at that point in time. As the session began in 2009, the need for in-state energy continued to ratchet up, escalate, but prices for crude oil by this time had started to fall. And it wasn't at all clear, you know, who was going to do what. And so an in-state project manager was named. And additional state funds were appropriated. And data that had been started by NSTAR and Anadarko working together to look at a foothills to South Central project was brought in-house and basically acquired by the state with an option to potentially reimburse those companies, NSTAR in particular, for that past work if anything ever came of it. And there wasn't a whole lot else that happened in 2009 during the session as it related to gas. But later that summer, in June, ExxonMobil aligned itself with TransCanada. And you know, it was an interesting development. They aligned themselves with TransCanada in a way that they were able to work together on the work plan that TransCanada had signed up for. But Exxon never really made itself a full party to the AGIA license. They never fully took on all of the obligations, in part because they still had an expectation and need for fiscal terms. They still were expecting to work out those kinds of matters on royalty and tax that really were going to matter to them in their decision-making going forward. We also at the time had this matter of some very serious litigation going on at Point Thompson. And there were questions about who actually had title to the gas in that field. So we now had a situation where BP and Conoco were working on Denali, and ExxonMobil and TransCanada were working on the APP project. As we rolled into 2010, the open season that TransCanada had committed to conducting was going to occur late in the summer, but legislators were growing more and more restless over the state of affairs with regard to in-state energy and Cook Inlet gas supply in particular. And during that session, the Cook Inlet Recovery Act was passed, as well as House Bill 369, which tasked the folks over at HFC with setting up a subsidiary and putting together a no-kidding plan to develop an in-state pipeline. You have to remember, in this particular period of time, both the Denali project and the APP were looking at large diameter projects, large diameter pipelines that would come through the interior and then head east into Canada and on into the North American pipeline grid. The largest part of the state in South Central was not necessarily going to be connected to that North Slope gas supply. And so the mission associated with House Bill 369 and that in-state project was fundamentally different than the commercialization effort. It was all about getting affordable energy, reliable energy from the North Slope to the major population centers in South Central. So with that, we rolled into the summer. The open season that was to be held under the license, was conducted at the end of July. TransCanada announced that they had received significant interest from multiple parties. And, you know, in layman's term, they received conditioned bids. They did conduct an open season that allowed parties to express their interest not only in the North America destination, but also a Valdez destination. And it wasn't very long before they determined that the interest was more significant for the Alberta leg, and that became the primary focus of the project licensed under the AGIA statute. A couple of months later, Denali had its open season, and they too announced the receipt of conditioned bids. And while we didn't receive the specific bids that were submitted, the administration was briefed by TransCanada, by the licensee, and to no one's surprise, one of the conditions that were attached had to do with the resolution of the fiscal terms, along with some other things that were commercial in nature. So here we were, 2010, the election that occurred that fall put Sean Parnell in the governor's seat in his own right, and we moved into 2011. And in 2011, we had an interesting sort of running dialogue. People wanted to know how successful had TransCanada been in resolving the conditions on their bids. At what point was their open season going to be deemed a success or a failure? And you know, there wasn't really a whole lot said or done about that during the session. But when the session ended in May, not long after, the sponsors of the Denali project announced that they were closing up shop, that market conditions in the lower 48 due to the abundance of shale gas supply made it unlikely that they were going to be commercially successful, and their respective boards withdrew their support for that project continuing. And you know, that was a pretty strong signal that the North America project itself likely was not going to happen. In July, the folks over at HFC, through their subsidiary, AGDC, released their project plan that had been directed under House Bill 369. And they showed through that report a path that that they showed was viable as a way to move North Slope gas into the South Central region for in-state use. And we had this sort of stuck betwixt and between moment where clearly two of the three producers on the North Slope were not interested in North America, yet the folks at TransCanada and ExxonMobil continued to work on putting together the draft resource reports and other associated information for a filing with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And it took a little while, but ultimately we saw the governor come out later in that fall of 2011 with a call to action. He called on all of the parties to refocus their energy on moving a large diameter pipeline to Tidewater and looking at markets in the Pacific Rim to sell LNG. And he asked them to do that under the AGEA framework. So it was that point in time, really, that we had this shift in focus, not away from the AGEA framework necessarily, but in terms of market destination.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bitt asked, when you say conditioned bids, does that mean confidential, can't be released? Is that?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, that's correct.
Okay. But you did say you did have some positive results during the open season process?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, yes. I think both projects announced that they had successfully received or attracted bids. They happened to be conditioned. And until those conditions are resolved or satisfied, it's almost like a participation ribbon in a foot race.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following up on Senator Meyer's line of questioning, you used an S, so that means that there's multiple bids. Are you at liberty to tell us how many different bids or the volume of bids?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, the administration did not receive the specific details or numbers behind, but in briefings that they provided to the administration at the time, they did communicate that there was a sufficient capacity bid for in the Alberta project to warrant continuing on with the development costs associated with the project. So they stopped doing any work on the Richardson Highway leg down to Valdez and focused exclusively on the Alberta leg.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then just last, if you could comment on whether you can, whether the administration has knowledge of other conditions beside financial certainty that were received on those conditional bids. Can you, do you have that information? And if you do, can you tell us what those conditions might be?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, I do have some knowledge, but I'm not able to speak about those things publicly.
Go ahead, Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I find that odd that we can speak about, you have the condition of financial certainty that you can speak about. So how come you, why is it that you can speak about financial certainty but you can't tell us what other conditions might be out there?
Commissioner, let's make sure you're answering the questions she's asking, because there may be a miscommunication here. You want to restate your first question? And
Mr. Chairman, the commissioner said that we, in the presentation, that we've received conditional bids that were under confidentiality agreements, and he shared that somehow we were able to release that one of those was fiscal terms. And that's been a battle that we've talked about inside the legislature. And so my question was, if we were able to disclose that financial terms were one of the conditions, I find it odd then that we can't share what other conditions we might be facing that we don't know at this time. So I just would like to know what conditions, if the administration knows what they are, how do we know whether the bill in front of us is addressing those conditions or not, or the importance of those conditions if we've had past bids. Didn't know if there's a time that we could get those or if that's yet to be determined.
Well, as we go through the process, there may be another opportunity to address this, but at this point I certainly don't want you to feel like you're breaching any confidentiality, so continue with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Fairclough, I will seek further understanding if the details are something that I can speak to in public. So as 2011 closed, we had a situation where the governor had called on the parties. And in early 2012, we had a unique experience. The three CEOs of the major North Slope producers, Jim Mulva with ConocoPhillips, Bob Dudley with BP, and Rex Tillerson from ExxonMobil, came to Anchorage. They met with the governor, and they then had a reception with members of the public, and that was a very important development in terms of where we are today, because it was in that meeting that the three CEOs discussed with the governor what it was going to take to resolve the litigation at Point Thompson. And one of the things that was quite clear is that in order to make Point Thompson a relevant part of the development plans for the companies, that there had to be an avenue to commercialize the gas. It wasn't enough just to look at the liquids production that was possible there. And so we needed a path to see our way through to Tidewater and the LNG markets beyond. And so when the legislature convened in January and the governor delivered his State of the State, he laid out a roadmap and he called on the companies to resolve Point Thompson litigation, to align themselves during the first quarter formally under an AGIA framework, and to, in the course of the year, complete their discussions by the third quarter with AGDC on the potential to to consolidate their efforts. He called on them to harden their numbers by the third quarter of 2012 and to identify a pipeline project and associated work schedule that Alaskans could look to and count on. If all of those milestones were met, then he was prepared to advance in the 2013 legislature gas tax legislation that would move the project forward. And so as we look back on this particular set of benchmarks, the Point Thompson litigation was resolved. It was resolved at the same time that a formal agreement was struck between the parties on a concept selection agreement that brought everybody together, all four parties, TransCanada, BP, Conoco, and ExxonMobil. So item number one, check. Item number two, check. Item number three, those discussions were completed, check. And in October, the governor received a letter signed by all four parties that included the project description, the timeline through, in a phase-gated approach, as well as the associated budget, the $45 to $65 billion, I believe the members are familiar with. So all of these things happened, but something else that was supposed to happen that year did not, and that was oil tax reform. In order for commercialization of gas at Prudhoe Bay in particular to work, there needs to be a healthy oil business. And unfortunately, in 2012, we did not have a healthy oil business, and it was incumbent upon the state to advance in the 2013 session oil tax reform. We had to make another go at it. And of course, that is what we did spend a fair bit of time on in 2013. But there's a couple of things.
Joe, could you answer a question? And when you talk about them forming up under an AGEA framework, and I think you mentioned that twice, I guess I don't really understand how you form up under an AGEA framework when these projects are so different. What does that mean when you say that?
Mr. Chairman, there were project plan amendments submitted by the licensee to the commissioners of DNR and DOR that were approved that allowed TransCanada in particular to conduct certain planning activities and field work that would support the overall project, the LNG project itself. There was information that was gathered, particularly from Live and Good North, that was eligible for reimbursement and then used by the parties to continue their discussions in exploring whether or not an LNG project, in fact, was going to provide the market opportunity that an Alberta-based project did not appear to open up. So it would be incorrect to say that all of the parties had signed on to AGEA. They had not. However, they were all working together with the state's licensee and continuing to talk about the things that mattered greatly to the state, that were embodied in the quote-unquote must-haves of AGEA. And
so essentially when you say under the AGEA framework, the key there is TransCanada, the licensee, correct? And then whatever was associated with that, and they, as long as they're following the rule of their AGEA license, then that would be called an AGEA framework.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay, go ahead.
So there were some key things in the Point Thompson settlement that was struck in 2012 that I think bear digging into a little bit. And, you know, the first is the settlement itself was struck with the very clear understanding that Point Thompson is the state's gas field. It's the state's land. It's the state's resource. And if nothing happened at Point Thompson within a specified period of time, that land would come back to the state free and clear, no more dispute. And in order for the working interest owners to retain clear title to the land, that they were going to have to basically earn their way into it. The initial production system that was contemplated would be constructed and delivering hydrocarbon liquids to TAPS by 2016, and that was the first phase of the settlement. As long as the working interest owners achieved that objective, they would earn title to the heart of the reservoir. But that was only the first part. If they wanted to retain the entire unit, there were additional steps, additional investments that they needed to make to more fully develop the field beyond just a 10,000 barrel a day cycling effort.
Commissioner, Senator Dunleavy, you have a question?
For the chair, could you again just briefly discuss what was at the heart of the dispute with Point Thompson? People in the press, people back home, they hear Point Thompson, but what was really at the heart of it?
So, through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, that's an excellent question. For many, many years, the resources at Point Thompson were thought to include both oil and gas, and clearly there's a lot of gas under extremely high pressure. And the understanding that we all have is that Point Thompson is what's called a retrograde condensate reservoir, meaning the gas is under such enormous pressure that the other hydrocarbons in the field are themselves in a gaseous state because of that intense pressure. But when you bring that gas to the surface and you let the pressure down, there are certain hydrocarbon liquids that fall out of that. And you can recover those liquids and push the gas back down into the reservoir and basically cycle. The amount of condensates in the Point Thompson field are estimated. There are reasonable estimates that go over a fairly broad range. The question that lies at the heart of the dispute that was ongoing between the state and the working interest owners was how much of that liquid could be recovered, and did the field need to be developed with liquids recovery as the primary means of production and commercial activity first before blowing down the field for purposes of gas?
So was it an oil or a gas field? Was that the question, basically?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, that's a fair way to look at it.
And this dispute, through the chair, went on for how many years?
The unit itself was terminated by Commissioner Mike Mangy in 2006, and the litigation itself carried on through decisions, remands, another trial with Judge Gleason, and ultimately an appeal up to the Supreme Court that was heard in 2012, and the settlement itself was struck March 30th of that year.
One last question, so through the chair, so what is that field considered today? I mean, obviously it was resolved, and it was based upon what? What is it? What is it considered?
It's a hydrocarbon field.
It's kind of a circular...
Yes, it is. The purpose of the initial production system is to test the methods that were basically in dispute between the state and the working interest owners. The initial production system that will go into operation in 2016 is expected to yield around 10,000 barrels a day, and one of the big questions is how long can that yield be sustained? Will that yield start to decline? And how efficient will the system actually be? We're both, all, going to learn from that initial production and be able to ascertain just whether or not it makes sense to expand that cycling program and recover all of that condensate before blowing down the gas.
Through the chair, I'm trying to just ask one last question, but he spurred something. So when the product, whatever that's called, and we bring it to market, whatever that's called, how is it viewed for the purpose of revenue for the state of Alaska? Is it taxed? How is it taxed? How is it? How would we receive revenue? How is it viewed?
The chair, Senator Dunleavy, the ownership interest that we have will be recovered in the form of royalties. The royalties at Point Thompson are a little bit higher than they are at Prudhoe Bay, but the production tax that is collected is done through 4355, which is an oil and gas production tax. So the hydrocarbon, whatever is produced and moved off lease, will be valued and taxed at 35%. If it's oil, then it will qualify for the production tax credit available under 4355. If it is gas, then it will not get a production credit. One thing that is important to note, though, is under SB 21, Point Thompson will qualify for the gross value reduction because of the timing of its commercial activity.
Thank you.
Joe, what is, it's a word that gets thrown around, I've never quite gotten a hint. What does blow down the gas mean?
Through the, Mr. Chairman, the term blow down refers to the release of the gas from the reservoir itself. Reservoirs, oil and gas fields are basically the combination of the oil and gas that bubbles up from the rocks that generated it, and it gets trapped, typically in a hard cap of formation of some sort, and it is typically under pressure. And it's that pressure of the gas and the oil that pushes the hydrocarbons into the well bores that get drilled into those fields. And as the field is produced, that pressure declines. When you're talking about a field that has gas or an associated field that has both oil and gas, like Prudhoe Bay, when that gas pressure is relieved, you have less energy in the field. The oil doesn't flow as well, and you ultimately don't recover as much oil. That's why the AOGCC pays extra special attention to the way in which any given field is managed and ultimately produced.
And therefore, blowdown means?
You're blowing down the gas. You're letting the gas out of the field and taking it off lease.
Oh, right.
You're not putting it back in.
Yeah, okay. Senator Fairclough.
Along Senator Kelly's question, have we determined whether the ring is around the field or at the bottom of the field? Do we know that yet?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, I would have to go back and dust off some of my information, but I know that in the course of the settlement discussions that we had with the working interest owners, we did gain access to additional geologic information that helped inform us of the likely state of affairs at the bottom of the field. And that was one of the key factors that led the department to take up the settlement as outlined in the terms that are here.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
So once we get the initial production system going in 2016, as I mentioned, the working interest owners will secure the heart of the reservoir, but not all of it. In order to secure the rest of it, They have to commit to more fully develop the field by 2019, and they have three options for more fully developing the field. One of those is to expand the cycling program, and they can do that by bringing in additional equipment at the surface and drilling additional wells. And expanding that cycling program to 30,000 barrels a day, and that would satisfy the terms of the agreement, and they would then earn all of the acreage in the unit. The second way that the working interest owners can secure the field is to blow the field down and take the gas over to Prudhoe Bay for injection there to recover black oil at Prudhoe. And that would allow them to secure all of the acreage. The third way is to sanction a major gas sale project. And the major gas sale project is not defined specifically as a North America project or a Tidewater project, but rather is defined as one that is more than 500 million cubic feet per day. And so this particular timeline is one that I think we'll come back to at a later point here. In 2013, when the legislature convened, the governor in his State of the State laid out another set of benchmarks, milestones to be achieved by the parties. And he called on the parties to do a couple of things. Number one, to nail the concept selection for their project. And he got pretty specific about a couple of things there. He wanted to know specifically the size of the pipe and the volumes of the gas that would be going through the pipe. And in particular, the location of the treatment plant. Was it going to be in the north? Was it going to be in the south? And then the size and scope of the liquefaction plant and storage tanks, and the number of offtake points that Alaskans could count on. By the end of spring, he was looking for the companies to finalize an agreement to advance the project to pre-feed and to ensure that a full summer field season was conducted and data gathered so that the information for regulatory applications could be assembled. At the same time, he called on the legislature to join a couple of members in the House in strengthening the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. And that clearly was done in the form of House Bill 4. And when we go back and look at the scorecard for these milestones, the first one was achieved. The third one was achieved. But the commitment to pre-feed, to complete pre-feed, was not completed. And so that left us in a little bit of a bind. It wasn't at all clear that that milestone had been achieved, and without it, the governor was struggling to figure out how we would demonstrate to the people of Alaska that it was time to take up fiscals, that this project was real. And so, of course, we didn't have a special session in the fall of 2013, but we did see an announcement by the parties in October that Nikiski is their preferred location for the liquefaction facility and marine terminal. So in that regard, we still saw progress, we still saw momentum continuing, but you know, we still had this nagging question on fiscals. And so what was going on there? Well, After the passage of Senate Bill 21 in the spring of 2013, myself and Deputy Commissioner Pawlowski literally left Juneau and headed to Houston. We went and attended LNG 17, but also began conversations with the sponsor companies around how to resolve our outstanding fiscal matters. And we had a very early breakthrough on this, and that was the divorce or divide between take and stability, that we would seek to have the take terms established by the legislature first and then take up stability at a later point in time when the companies were prepared to make bigger commitments. And in essence, what we have is a principle that there will be commensurate commitments by both sides as the project development matures and we get closer to the point that the really big commitments and decisions get made. But we still had some pretty big fundamental differences, and really those differences stem from our misalignment of interest. The state's interests are driven almost singularly by the desire for a low tariff. A low tariff allows us to realize a higher royalty value through the netback. It also is one of the primary hurdles that third parties have to clear in order to get their resource to market through this infrastructure. Another big difference that we had was an LNG plant and terminal is not regulated in the sense that a pipeline is. There's not regulation for access by other parties, and there's not regulation for rate setting. And that created a bit of a black hole for us, a black box that we weren't sure what would happen to our royalty value, our production tax value, and really, frankly, made us a bit nervous. And that's something that could be solved through a liquefaction service fee that would be calculated similar to a pipeline tariff. But going back to the first point, low tariffs, low charges, high netbacks, integrated companies like the other three parties here are not driven by the same interests. Because they participate in each component of the project, the value chain, they don't care which pocket the money's going into, in essence. And so they have to pay attention to different things that matter to their respective boards of directors and shareholders. And so we frankly were at a bit of a loggerheads. It was a stalemate. How do we break through that? And what we found in the course of our conversations was the key to resolve those differences was for the state to assume an equity role in all of those components of the value chain, that it would allow each party to finance their share of the project on terms that worked for them. And so that was sort of the first part of the breakthrough. The second was with regard to expansion policy. For several years, the administration's policy has been to seek a rolled-in approach to tariff design for expansions, and it's something that caused the other parties a great deal of concern.
What does that mean? What is a rolled-in?
Mr. Chairman, whenever a project is expanded, there's additional cost that comes into the picture. And sometimes those expansions are cheap, and that means the expansion is efficient, and the per unit cost goes down for everybody. But sometimes those expansions are so costly that the per unit cost goes up. And there is, in the rate-making world, a methodology called rolled-in rate-making that blends those together and causes everybody's tariff to go up and not just the expansion party. So As we thought through the repercussions of equity participation and considered our continued interest in a favorable expansion policy, we landed on a method of allowing expansions to occur on a sole risk keep-whole basis, meaning the original parties to the project that each are going to have their respective pipe in a pipe will have their own separate tariff, if you will. And if an expansion occurs by party A, the other three parties don't have to participate and can be left alone. Their tariffs don't necessarily go down, their costs don't necessarily go down, but they don't go up either. And this really is the essence of the resolution of our differences. It is what allowed us to move forward with the development of the Heads of Agreement and ultimately the legislation that will be before this body soon.
Senator Bishop and then Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, Party A expansion is allowed. If one party wants to expand and the other two don't want to participate, you made that description, but there is an expansion and Party A paid for it. What happens maybe 5 or 6 years down the road where parties B and C now take advantage of this expansion that was paid for by Party A?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, in that scenario, parties B and C would have to pay for that second expansion. Under the principles laid out in Appendix A of the HOA, any party can initiate an expansion. The other parties may participate in that expansion and make that expansion bigger, but they don't have to. They're not obligated to. So in the scenario you described, in that case, Party A would initiate the first expansion all by themselves. And then a couple of years later, parties B and C would initiate a second expansion that Party A doesn't participate in. And so the parties B and C would have to pay for that expansion. And how it impacted them and their underlying economics would be part of their business calculus. But it would be transparent. They would be able to see how it's going to affect them, and they'd be able to calculate the relative value of that expansion for them and their customers.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, could you talk to us, the people of Alaska, about the different ways that are traditional in the form of gas and gas expansion? One of the issues that Alaskans point to on the Trans-Alaska pipeline is an inability for smaller producers to access the line. So maybe you could talk about how that particular model is different than what is being proposed today, and then make sure that you hit on the traditional choices that we have in how gas moves, at least in most pipelines across the U.S. and internationally.
Sure. And as you go, would you explain expansion for the terms of what we're talking about is just volume of gas through the pipe? When someone goes on an expansion project, it's not in the field or anything like that. It's just volume through the pipe, correct?
So Mr. Chairman, a given pipeline can carry so much gas,
right,
depending upon the compressors that are able to push the gas through the pipeline. In order to move more gas, you typically have to add more compression. Mm-hmm. When you add more compression, you consume more fuel in order to reach the pressures necessary to move more gas. At a certain point, it actually becomes cheaper to lay more pipe than to continue to consume more and more gas in the form of fuel. So when you reach that point, it's called looping, right, where you do physically make the pipe bigger.
Right. But that's what we're talking about, all in
that's
the pipe.
Exactly.
It has nothing to do with either end. Okay. Now to Senator Fairclough's
question. So many of the challenges that were faced by third parties or independents with regard to TAPS are a product of problems we faced 15, 20 years ago. And during the period that existed, you know, from the mid-80s to, you know, the early 2000s, the tariffs on TAPS were established or charged on the basis of a settlement. They were not at a fully adjudicated, just and reasonable tariff, and so there were parties, including at times the state, who thought that settlement was producing tariffs that were too high, that they were higher than would have been reached under a just and reasonable method adopted by the FERC. So when you're talking about access, there's the opportunity to physically access the pipe and put your product in. TAPS is a common carrier, and what that means is anybody who shows up that can pay the tariff gets in. And if the pipe is full, the people who are already there get prorated down, and room is made for the new party. But you have to be able to afford the tariff. And like I said, back in the late 80s and early 90s, when oil prices were much lower, TAPS tariffs were a high percentage overall of the value of a barrel of oil. And so it did create some hardships. It created some competitive disadvantages for non-TAPS owners. Today we do have a just and reasonable tariff adjudicated by the FERC. TAPS remains a common carrier. And oh, by the way, we have some room in it, so let's fill it up. When it comes to gas pipelines, especially here in North America, pipelines are regulated and their business is conducted in a very different way. Rather than being common carriers, they typically operate as contract carriers, meaning the space in the pipeline is reserved by those who have contracts for space in that pipe. And that contract entitles them to that capacity day in, day out. And if somebody shows up and wants to get into the pipeline, if there isn't any spare room, then there has to be a change in the pipe made, either the addition of compression or looping. And that new party has to pay for that expansion, for that capacity. The history of rate making and rate regulation in the United States has varied. There was a point in time when all pipelines in North America were governed by a rolled-in methodology. But as part of the deregulation and efforts to promote competition, back in, it was a transition that occurred in the 70s and 80s, largely the 80s under President Reagan, we moved away from that in the United States and moved to an incremental pricing methodology for those expansions. And that actually helped lead to the construction of more pipelines in more parts of the country. And that arguably is a good thing for the U.S. In Canada, they largely continue to rely on rolled-in rate making for expansion services. And they have, in that country, I think it's fair to say, fewer pipeline companies, and the tension there is on competition. How do you get pipelines competing to provide the service that the customers and the market at large depend on? In our case, our situation here in Alaska, part of the reason that we have been a supporter of rolled-in rate making for a natural gas pipeline from the North Slope to market is because we don't think there are going to be competing pipelines. We think there's going to be a pipeline. And that really drives our thinking in how we approach the questions, those tough questions about competition and fair access for all parties. And, you know, the state is very likely to be a beneficiary of the extra development that occurs outside of Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson. It is very likely that the additional gas resources that get found and developed are going to be from state properties. And so we have an interest in seeing that gas developed and moved to market. The other parties in this project, namely the other gas parties, Conoco, BP, and Exxon, they'll be interested in those expansions if they have some of that other gas. But they won't necessarily be interested in those expansions if it's not their gas. And so this question of rolled-in rates versus incremental rates for expansions is something that we all have a different view on depending upon our interest in the question. And that's where the role of TransCanada actually comes into play in this larger body of agreements. TransCanada's in the business of moving gas. The way they make more money is to move more gas. And to the extent that we want to see more gas move and they want to see more gas move, we're aligned. And that's something that we're seeking to leverage in this body of agreements. I kind of covered a lot of territory there, and Mr. Chairman, I've just asked if I answered the right things from Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, Alaska is paying attention on access and whether new production could make it onto a line, so I think that you've provided that explanation. The only thing that I can think that would be the additional question is how likely it is would the state be paying for the expansion versus partners. And it seems to me that, again, a pipeline operator certainly would be, it seems to me they would be wanting to participate because when they invest those capital dollars, they get a rate of return based on that expansion for 30 years plus. And so it wouldn't be the Alaska standing alone to create that partnership. But that would be my question as an Alaskan. How likely is it that if someone was coming for expansion, would they be looking at the state alone doing that, or would others want a piece of that action per se based on a rate of return over a long period of time?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, that's an excellent question. And it's one of the reasons why we think our agreement with TransCanada is in our broader long-term interest, because we may not be the ones involved in an expansion. We will have a contract with TC for capacity to make sure our gas gets to Alaskans and gets to the liquefaction terminal. But let's say there is a discovery on federal land, an NPRA. You know, we're not going to have a royalty volume associated with that gas. So, you know, we may not actually be participating in that expansion directly. So we need to make sure that our contract with TC is structured on terms that works for us, not just now, but over the life of the contract period. 25 years is what's contemplated in the MOU. And something that I think also affects our thinking a little bit in this particular context is we're now talking about an LNG project rather than a project in North America. And what that means is, in the past, we've been concerned about all these issues on pipelines because it was the pipeline that was going to provide the means to market. We now have introduced a new component, and that is the liquefaction terminal. And the liquefaction terminal now is going to be the primary hurdle for third parties to get their gas to market. And while we probably can rely on regulation in the pipeline world, the FERC does not regulate marine terminals and liquefaction terminals for access or rates. And so in order to make way, make room for expansions of the liquefaction terminal, we had to reach agreement with the other parties on that front as well. And that's something that I think is a big deal in the expansion principles, again, going back to Appendix A. And what we've secured there is that all of the common facilities, the dock itself, the loading arms, the storage tanks, the utilities, all of those are going to be available for expanded use and operation. But the original trains, the original liquefaction trains themselves, will only be modified or expanded if all of the parties agree. And that's because those trains are so important to fulfilling the contractual obligations in the SPAs, the sales and purchase agreements for the LNG. In order to make sure that those trains don't become a bottleneck, an obstacle or a hurdle that prevents additional gas development, we've secured in the principles here an ability for any one of the parties to add an entirely new train. And that, Mr. Chairman, I think is really important. We'll be able to show in a later presentation, and I promise not to kill the committee by PowerPoint, but we'll be able to show the value of an expansion, a one-train expansion to the state. And it's staggering because the next train that gets added is going to benefit from the original investments made to install the original infrastructure. That means that that next train is going to be much more efficient, not only technically, but economically. And that's where you're going to make a ton of money.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, before I served in the legislature, the only train I knew about was a choo-choo train, and it ran down a set of tracks. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about the processing and how that terminology, we're not using an acronym now, we're using a train,
yes.
And people may or may not understand what a train is. So if we, just a short
yes.
Definition of a train.
Fairclough, that's an excellent point to keep in mind. We sometimes get lost in this terminology because we get so used to using it. But in essence, a train is a unit of the processing component, either on the North Slope to remove the CO2, or at the other end of the pipeline, the liquefaction train. It's the piece of equipment that reduces the temperature and increases the pressure on the gas to get it into a liquid state. And these trains, these units, basically are modular. We're going to start, in this case, with three of them. We're going to have three trains for GTP, and we're going to have three trains for liquefaction, and so they'll match up. In order to expand the capacity of the facility to make more LNG, you're going to have to add an additional train in all likelihood. So when we talk about expansions of the pipeline, it's great that we can expand it and move more gas through it. But if you can't make more LNG, well, what's the point?
Go ahead.
So, Mr. Chairman, a question that we've gotten is, what's different this time? You know, many Alaskans have gas line fatigue. They're not impressed. They're a little tired of this conversation, and they just want to be able to count on energy for their homes and businesses, and really don't understand what all this business is about. So there's a few things here that I've identified that I think help tell the story. What's different? Well, one thing that's different is that Point Thompson has been resolved. The working interest owners understand clearly what it's going to take to retain title to the gas. If you don't have title to the gas, people probably aren't going to be willing to sign a long-term SPA to buy that gas from you in the form of LNG. So that's a big deal. All of the necessary parties have aligned in the heads of agreement on a way to advance the project. We've got all three of the producers who, under their leases, control 98% of the proven gas resources on the North Slope. We've got a preeminent pipeline builder in the form of TransCanada, and we have the state's entity charged with getting gas to Alaskans, AGDC. The commercial issues that in the past have bedeviled just the producers amongst themselves, they're being resolved. We've seen in the concept selection agreement the formation of an organization where we've got a clear project lead. We're leveraging the expertise of the individual companies who play a role here in Alaska. We've got BP on the upstream stuff. We've got TransCanada in the pipeline part. And we've got ConocoPhillips, who operates the only liquefaction facility in the United States, in the lead on the liquefaction component of the project. And we've got ExxonMobil with their world-class project management skills employed as the overall project lead. And that's something that, for those of you who remember back to the SGDA experience, wasn't really achieved. There was talk of a large LLC agreement, but they hadn't sorted out who was going to be the project lead, who was going to have the GTP, who was going to lead the pipeline. Those things were still being fought out between and among the companies. In this case, that picture is becoming clearer, much clearer. And that's an important point here. The last bullet on the left there is the gas to oil ratio. And this is something that I think I talked about with this committee in the first week of session. At Prudhoe Bay, we have an associated field where both gas and oil are present. And we talked about this a little bit ago, Mr. Chairman, where if you release the pressure associated with that gas, you take energy out of the reservoir and you ultimately collect or recover less of that oil. So in years past, when these project sponsors have considered the commercial value of gas efforts, they've had to account for the lost oil that they wouldn't recover in the long term. That basically was a negative drag on the economics as they sized them up. And it's important to note that that's not just a drag on them, it's a drag on us as the royalty owner in the reservoir. But you can only re-inject the gas so many times to recover that oil until you reach a point of diminishing returns. You do ultimately reach a point where re-injecting the gas no longer provides that economic benefit of oil recovery. And we're getting, we think, to a point here in this next decade where that oil impact is approaching a very small number. It's not to say that it goes away entirely, but it's getting to a place where it's time to start blowing down Prudhoe Bay and commercializing the gas. And that gives the companies an economic motive to pursue this project. We have a clear articulation of all the parties' commitments that are embodied in the HOA, and we'll be able to advance this project on a phased approach where they'll take a step, we'll take a step, and Alaskans will be able to see very clearly what it is we're getting into and what we're getting in return. In the case of Senate Bill 138, we're asking for 2 years, and something on the order of $100 million. That's all we're asking for. We're going to have to come back and show Alaskans and the legislature what it is we've done with the terms embodied in the HOA and the legislation itself, and more fully papered it for your consideration in 2015. So what we have is a term sheet level approach. We have what we think are the basic outlines, the basic tenets of this, and what we would like is the authority to go paper those terms, to advance them to a higher level of detail that we'll be able to bring back for your consideration at a later time. We're not asking at this point for a long-term commitment because, frankly, the other parties aren't prepared to make a long-term commitment. We're not at that point yet. We hope to be. We hope to be in 2 years' time. And if we reach it, you know, that'll be a good day for Alaska. One thing that I wanted to show the committee to illustrate the point is a slide you saw last night. Ms. Podoval presented a line chart that shows the state's revenue picture. And this represents an oil-only world and an oil-plus-gas world. And clearly, it's in the state's interest to see this gas resource developed to help support the public services that we all strive to provide in the course of running the state's business. What I want to show you next, though, is the producer's revenue picture. I think we should all pay very close attention to. It's the same basic picture with the blue line representing the producer's revenue stream. And in the oil-only world, it continues to go down and get smaller and smaller. All the facilities and infrastructure necessary to commence commercial sales of gas. That's gonna be a hit to them. But we think, and I think they believe, it's going to be worth it when you see what happens in 2023 and their revenue picture bumps back up again and they get to a very healthy place from a business perspective. So, Mr. Chairman, I think that for those skeptics out there who wonder whether the companies are serious, my answer is we better hope so.
Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you talked about, and I want you to choose the words because I don't want to paraphrase incorrectly, but we're going to reach a point, was it 2020, in which the GOR lines would cross. And we would then be looking at gas. How do you want to describe that so I don't mess it up? Is production going down? Is it? Why don't you give it another shot for me?
Mr. Through the Chair, Senator Dunleavy, the issue here is whether the production of gas and the removing of that gas from the field causes a negative consequence on oil production. If there's a negative consequence to oil production, then that's something that a rational business is going to take into account when deciding whether or not to produce that gas. What we see in our models is that sometime in the 2020s, not 2020, but in the 2020s, the oil impacts at Prudhoe Bay reach a point that I don't want to say zero, but negligible. And it allows companies at Prudhoe to evaluate gas production purely as a revenue generator and no longer having to take into account those oil losses that would be associated with gas production. Is that helping?
Senator Dunleavy?
Well, to the chair, there's a couple things. So I think we had a similar conversation a couple weeks ago. There was Prudhoe and then there was Prudhoe. And one Prudhoe is not the same as the other Prudhoe. Are we talking about the Prudhoe or the Prudhoe? Which Prudhoe are we talking about? You understand what I'm saying?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, we're talking about the initial production area at Prudhoe Bay in the Saddle Roquette Reservoir. So the original Prudhoe that has both the oil and the gas all together in one horizon. Because of the extraordinary complexity and richness of our hydrocarbon system there, there are additional horizons above and below the IPA that can produce oil and gas that are unaffected by these particular decisions. So it's certainly possible that additional oil resources can be developed once this blowdown of the Prudhoe Bay gas cap begins.
We're still planning on arresting the degree of decline, correct, in oil?
Through the chair, absolutely.
And the use of gas is not going to affect that process, correct?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, that is correct and will require approvals from the AOGCC to ensure that's the case. Going a step further, cleaning up the gas at Prudhoe Bay will require pulling CO2 out of the gas stream. That CO2 in turn can be used for enhanced oil recovery to help increase or improve the recovery of oil either at Prudhoe or any of the other nearby fields.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Just a comment.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not superstitious, maybe a little bit, and this is not a dig on you at all. Sometimes, you know, I always like to preface things. My zeal gets ahead of my knowledge a lot of times, but you had made a comment, and I appreciate your enthusiasm as, and I share your enthusiasm, but you said, you know, with a fourth train, I believe we'd make a ton of money. I think I remember another commissioner saying the last pipeline was wildly economic, too. So, anyway.
Any other questions, comments? Joe, oh, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, given the subject here was sort of the recent history on gas and, you know, where have we been, where are we, and where do we hope to be? Governor Parnell delivered a speech at the Alliance back in January where he quoted Lincoln and said, time is a great thickener of things. And I'm going to have a copy of that speech delivered to the committee members. I think it's well worth the read and provides his take on this same history and something I think members would benefit from.
Joe, this was extremely valuable to me. I hope it was to the rest of the committee. We're trying to kind of ease into this as the bill is heading our way, and I know there are a lot of technical issues that are being addressed in the other committee, and we will get to those. We'll have a look at those as well. But I thought it was very good that we could just start walking into this and understand the history, the general terms. Last night, of course, you were here, I think, when Ms. Potavel testified and Mr. Persley, and I found those extremely valuable as well. Thanks. You've always been a great help to me when I'm trying to get my head around these big issues, and you have a great talent for putting into words. At least I can understand, and I think others can too. Anyway, if there's no other business to come to the committee, appreciate your help, Joe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And tomorrow at
9.
And then we have another at 5, and Senator Meyer will be chairing that one as well. And I'm chairing the...
At 9.
9 o'clock, yeah.
But go ahead.
See you tomorrow.